Well, I get chosen because I'm an expert in it to talk about what holds us back. I'm going to read also a couple of quotes from Master. One is, "Beloved Father, I know that all things are lawful. Therefore, if I sow an action, I shall reap a habit. If I sow a habit, I shall reap a character. If I sow a character, I shall reap a destiny." Isn't that beautiful? It's something to learn and kind of keep repeating. If I sow an action, I reap a habit. If I sow a habit, I reap a character. And if I sow a character, I shall reap a destiny. So it starts with little things. I also want to read, "To understand karma, you must realize that thoughts are things. The very universe, in the final analysis, is composed not of matter, but of consciousness. Matter responds far more than most people realize to the power of thought. For willpower directs energy, and energy in turn acts upon matter. Matter indeed is energy." So I want to talk a little bit about some of the things that hold us back from God. This is obviously a theme that has been present for millennia in religions. People are very fond of making lists of the things that hold us back. They're the seven deadly sins. I had to look up to find out what the seven deadly deadly sins are. You know, you hear about them, but frankly, I haven't memorized them. So the seven deadly sins are pride, envy, gluttony, lust, anger, greed, and sloth. Okay, you can forget them now. Just don't associate with those guys. In the great Mahabharata, and from which the Gita is a part, there are listed on the one side, as Devi said, the world is complex and God is simple. So the two sides, the warriors on the two sides are listed, and it's such a wonderful kind of analogy and paradigm that King Material Desire, the ruler, although he isn't the king, actually, he's the son of the king, but the king is blind, so his son has taken over the rulership of our material physical consciousness, sensory consciousness. His name is Duryodhana. Master calls him King Material Desire. And he has 99 brothers, and every one of those 99 brothers represents some aspect that holds us back. Anger, greed, the tendency to cheat, on and on and on. So 99 of them. And he also, as Devi mentioned, has some major players in the court who otherwise, they're like advisors in the court, but otherwise they're kind of neutral. But when they get in a battle, the real battle takes place in the spine. So when they get in a battle, which in this case is the battle of the soul trying to achieve self-realization, then because they have lived in the court of the material aspect of our nature, they end up siding with the materialistic consciousness. And one of the chief ones, Devi mentioned, is Dronacharya. Habit sides ultimately with that which holds us back. Bhishma, the grandsire, the one most honored, he represents ego, and ego holds us back. Ego is the soul identified with the body and the personality. All of those things hold us back. Also, those aspects in our own nature hold us back. Master said, and I've always found this very interesting, he said that when people first come on the spiritual path in any particular lifetime, he said the soldiers of the good side come forth. So often you have people, when they first get on the spiritual path, they have more experiences in the first month than they're going to have in the next 20 years. And, you know, we hear occasionally people will give a class to beginners, and they'll talk about the Hong Sa technique, and the next week somebody will come back and say, what was that big light with the star in the center that I saw when I practiced Hong Sa? You know, it was just blazing. Then they won't see it again for 40 years, you know. So those soldiers, what Master explained was the soldiers of our past efforts, our past karma, positive, come back in order to kind of hook us into being on the spiritual path. And then we get into territory that we haven't yet conquered. And that's the battle of the good and dark. And as Davy said, the more we can wade in the water and get into that stream of positive consciousness, because ultimately that's all we are, is an extension of God. But the delusion that we aren't that is what's holding us back. So instead of going on to more and more lists of, and they can be comprehensive, of what's holding us back, I thought that I wanted to talk about some things, because this is a more unique audience that we're gathered here today. All of us are serious devotees, and most of us don't have to fight against certain kinds of worldly tendencies that otherwise hold people back. Alcoholism and drug addiction and violent associates and terrible neighborhoods and poverty and lack of education and all those kinds of things that were in this lifetime, our enemies are a little bit more refined and our battles are a little bit more inward rather than quite so outward. So I thought I would talk about things that particularly apply to us living here in the village, or those of us who don't live in an Ananda community but have seriously offered our life to God. So the first and greatest enemy for most of us is forgetfulness. That we go along, it's this beautiful, beautiful terrain out here. We can walk for days after day after day and forget to even look out at the horizon. You know, we're focused down here. Master had that beautiful vision where he saw that in vision he was in this marketplace, and everybody was just kind of focused down in their little stalls, and it was dusty and hot. And nobody ever looked up from their little stalls. And how often were like that? Well, every once in a while they looked up, and there was this high mountainous, beautiful scene out there. And they would look up, and they'd get a wistful look on their face. And then they'd kind of say, oh, it's too high for me, and they'd go back to their dusty little work again. And Master, too, was there, and he looked up at that mountain, and he had that same thought as Davy read, you know, that those subconscious thoughts that try to draw us back. And he said, oh, it's too high. And he was about to go back to the dusty little marketplace, and he said, well, it may be too high, but at least I can put one foot in front of the other and head toward that high mountain, the high mountain, obviously, of self-realization. And so he did, and eventually arrived there. Well, forgetfulness has us look up once in a while at that high mountain and then kind of shake our head, say it's too high, and we go back to our dusty little tasks and forget the expansiveness of it. And so we have to, if we're going to overcome these things, We have to work against them. There is a Native American tradition. I don't know whether it's literally true or not, but it's certainly psychologically and spiritually true. So the Native American tradition is that wherever there is a poisonous plant, there is the antidote growing somewhere within sight of that poisonous plant. And so psychologically, wherever there is a poisonous tendency, there is an antidote very close to that tendency. So if the poisonous tendency is forgetfulness or indifference, what is it that we can use as the antidote? It isn't enough just to say, well, don't be forgetful. Because if you're forgetful, you forget not to be forgetful. Reminds me of an old kind of comedy routine where this fellow calls up his psychiatrist and he says, "Hello, Dr. Johnson, I am doing really, really well. Everything's going well. I'm doing those things that you told me to do. I'm feeling much better. There's just one little thing. Whenever I say a particular word, I just forget everything. And yes, Dr. Johnson, I don't know why it happens, but that if ever I say aardvark, hello, Dr. Johnson, everything's going really quite well for me." And he goes on about five times saying the word aardvark and resetting again. So it isn't enough for us just to say, I'm forgetful, I shouldn't be forgetful, so I won't be forgetful, because the very nature of the mind is that way. So we have to build in some antidotes to that. One is to build in little constant remembrances. That's why I was absolutely charmed when I looked at the phone last night and saw on the little readout behind the sunbeams, "Is Rick here?" Oh, he didn't get a chance to come. Anyway, that's a glorious thing to do, to have that. Where in the world do you have your phone company work as your spiritual advisors? I mean, it's charming. So having that, but the farther out from our own hearts and minds something is, the more easily it is to forget it and the less power it has. So we have to begin to internalize that. One of the very strong practices is, in India they call it japa or a mantra, or you repeat a prayer or you repeat a chant. One time many years ago, in many traditions, they give you a mantra that you repeat over and over again. And in many traditions, it's a personalized mantra that is just for you, and you repeat that. And Master didn't have that tradition, although he certainly said that we should repeat mantras or chants. He said chanting is half the battle. So one time many, many years ago, I'd been on the path just a few years, probably 3 or 4 years, I kind of wanted a mantra of my own. And so I went to Swamiji and I asked him. And he said, "It's better not to have just a outer mantra, but if you want to repeat something, repeat Om Guru, Om Guru, Om Guru, Om Guru." Some few months ago, I thought, you know, it would be nice if, as the Sevaka order, Ananda's monastic order, if we had a little kind of an affirmation or a prayer that we ended our meditations with. So I had this little thought, and I asked Swamiji about it. And he said, "Oh, I don't know that that's such a good idea." And I said, "Well, I didn't mean, sir, trying to defend my position here. I didn't mean, sir, that we're going to repeat it out loud at the end of each meditation. I meant, you know, that everybody would repeat it silently." He said, "I still don't think that's such a good idea." He said, "I hardly ever pray in words anymore." Isn't that interesting? hardly ever pray in words anymore. So words are an intermediary level. Repeating a mantra is an intermediary level. And I know from experience that you can go on and on, repeat a mantra, and be just as mindless about the presence of God as if you're not repeating a mantra. Nonetheless, having said all of that, the repetition of that helps remind one of God. But if you can repeat something, but then get behind the words and begin to understand it, it gets to take on more and more power. For many years, when I run, I've repeated a mantra when I run. And I don't know, you know, you get these habits and they get started, and then that habit becomes familiar and comfortable for you. And so my running mantra is, Jai Guru Omkara, Jai Jai Sat Guru Omkara, Brahma Vishnu Sada Shiva, Hara 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 Mahadeva. And then I end up, Shri Guru Deva Yogananda. And it's, you know, it's a nice rhythmic chant and so on. Well, just Swami doesn't encourage us too much to do Sanskrit chanting, because he said for most of us, it's just a repetition of words that we don't understand. And so better to do more of Master's chanting, where it's in English and we understand what we're saying. But behind that, behind the words, the real meaning of that chant, Omkara, is the sound of Om. And so you're saying the real Guru, Jai Guru, victory to the Guru, the sound of Om. Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva are the sound of Om. Omkara. And then the Satguru, the true Guru, that which leads you to God, is the sound of Om. Well, you can repeat that chant, but much more powerful, if you can do it, is to try to listen to the sound of Om as you walk or as you run. If you can get your mind a little bit calm, you can hear that sound. I was going to do a little experiment yesterday, but I was going to... Let's all be silent right now for a moment. Do you hear the sound outside, a little bit of the breeze? Can you hear the sound of Om? Okay, I don't want to stop too long, but it's always there. It's always going on. It's just that we don't tune in. So if you tune in to it a little bit, then you can feel and hear that. But don't do it so much mentally. There's also a beautiful, as we walk, there's a beautiful and very powerful Vedic prayer that Master has put into one of the whispers. But it's essentially, O Lord, I perceive thee in front of me and behind me, to the left and to the right. I perceive thee above me and beneath me. I perceive thee on the inside and the outside. O Lord, I perceive thee everywhere, for thou art everywhere. And it's one thing to repeat that verbally, and it has some power. It has some power to remind. But if you can feel that you're walking or working, or your day exists in this kind of bubble of God's presence, bubble of God everywhere. As a great disciple of Yogananda's put it, he said, I live in a bubble of joy, and I will never allow anything to burst my bubble of joy. His temple was burned down, and he went, so the story was told to me. This is Oliver Black. His temple and some other buildings were burned down, and he went, and he was a little bit saddened. He went to his house. Then he came back at dinner time as if nothing had happened. And he said, for a few moments there, I allowed that thought of loss to get inside my bubble of joy, but then I pushed it out. I won't let anything burst my bubble of joy. What a wonderful, if we can feel during our activity that God's presence is there and feel that we're in that bubble of joy, that's the antidote to restlessness. To forgetfulness. So try to hear Om. Master said that one of the most powerful of all spiritual techniques is to try to keep your consciousness at the point between the eyebrows. Because when you keep your consciousness there, it stops the other forgetful, restless thoughts. Okay, I'll go on to a few others. So number two on my list of the most wanted that we want to capture and lock away for life is associating with negativity and avoiding the light. Davey talked about it a little bit. It can take many, many forms. It can take the form of gossiping. It can take the form of getting on the internet too much. It can take the form of watching movies that we shouldn't watch, reading books that we shouldn't watch. But associating or stepping in, I love that image that she said, that when you get into the water, either positive or negative, at the edge of the bank, it doesn't have much power yet. If you step into that negative current, the first step or two, it's easy to get out. The more you get in, the more the powerful stream is going to carry you down. And as Master said, sow an action, you reap a habit. Sow the action of stepping into negativity, you're going to reap the habit of that downward pulling. Sow a habit, you reap a character. You'll get the character of, and we're all born in this lifetime with the character of the actions and habits that we have sown and reaped in past lives. So in this life, sow those habits, create those characters and destinies that are the stream that moves us up. Just that downward pulling stream, the one we talked about yesterday, just don't hang out with Mr. Down and Out. If you want to, he's got a lot of seedy places that he'll take you. But if you want to find God, that's one of the obstacles that will hold you back. So, if you are associating with negativity or avoiding the light, have you ever noticed how people who are in a slump, they don't come to sadhana, they don't come to Sunday service, they don't come to satsangs, they avoid those things that will draw them in an upward direction? So one of the antidotes is, even if you don't want to, force yourself to go into those places that will be uplifting for you. The very magnetism, everything in the world, Master said, has magnetism. The chakras have magnetism, our hands have magnetism, people have magnetism, thoughts have magnetism. Everything is a magnetic interchange. Even if you're stuck in a downward pulling direction, get yourself in the presence of upward pulling magnetism. Environment is stronger than willpower. We heard a charming thing the other day. Ananta is here. He should close his ears here. It's a charming story about Ananta. This was on Sunday, we were having lunch, and someone who they're now in the Sacramento community that Ananta and Maria led for many, many years, 20 years or something like that. And this person has moved there from another community. He said, you know, one of the things I noticed is there's hardly any negativity in the Sacramento community. You don't hear people talking negatively or complaining very much. He said, they used to go to Ananta and they would complain, and he just laughed at them. And so they learned not to do that. And now they don't do it anymore. Isn't that great? We should all have an Ananta that we can go to when we're feeling a little bit we need to gripe. Yeah, and so anyway, get somebody that'll laugh at you when you want to complain. There's an analogy that they use in the schools for the kind of different levels, tamasic, rajasic, and sattvic levels. When you're really in a tamasic or downward pulling energy, you're just stuck. And the visual image they use is, you know, one is you're kind of walking and there's a little bit of mud, but then there's another level where you're just stuck in tarry quicksand and you can't get out. When you're really down, the antidote is not to work with the mind, it's to work with the body. Get out and become active. Do deep breathing. Do something that gets the energy going. You don't have to worry too much about the direction of the energy at that point, because tamasic consciousness doesn't have enough energy to get it directed. So get your energy going. Get out, walk, do some sport or exercise. Even better is do a little purposeful activity, which would be to go and serve somebody and help somebody. And that'll get the energy going so that association with negativity, you get out of that stream and into the stream of positivity. Okay, the third culprit on the list, restlessness. Just the tendency to get restless. You know, that you can be going along perfectly fine, and then all of a sudden, oh, I need to go to Roseville. I need to go to the mall. I need to... Does that resonate with anybody? So, you know, obviously it's not a bad thing to get out and change the environment once in a while. But if you have a tendency, if you have a habit of becoming restless, then work against that habit, because that restlessness of the mind is what's going to take us away from the direction of our energy and consciousness toward God. In the Gita, it's put just beautifully, Arjuna, it's so poignant. And so the Gita, when you read it and study it, it's just so absolutely wonderful. There's a point in there where Arjuna, you can just hear him kind of, as Devi said, he represents devotee everyone. And he says, oh, Krishna, what is it that even against our will draws us outward and downward? And, you know, he's representing here the consciousness of the devotee meditating, especially on the deeper level, but also here we're talking a little bit more about our activity. What is it, even against our will, that draws us into that outward or downward? And Krishna says it is the rajasic guna. There's an actual force in the universe which is keeps everything restless. And you see it on the waters. There the restlessness is represented by the wind. And the wind blows on the waters, and it can be a still lake. Wind blows on the waters, and it becomes, creates waves. Well, one of the antidotes is also the wind. The mind, Arjuna says, the mind seems more difficult to control than the wind. It's actually a spiritual teaching. The mind is hard to control, but the wind, here representing the breath, is easier to control. The mind is harder to control than the wind. It's a true spiritual teaching. So do some pranayamas, do some of our techniques. In fact, I'll skip over our number five on the list is the non-use of our techniques. That's the ultimate culprit on my little list of five for this morning. So if you're having difficulty, go back to the basic techniques. Sit and practice. Practice Hong Sa for a whole meditation, trying to go deeper and deeper and deeper. Ultimately, the goal of Hong Sa is to go beyond the breath. You think after 10 minutes you've done enough? Master, when he was a young boy, 8 or 9 years old, would practice it for 7 hours. Said he got a lot of benefit out of 7 hours practicing Hong Sa. So practice it more, practice Om more, especially practice Kriya more, so that the non-use of the things that have been given us by the Guru is also a way of doing the activities that pull us out of attunement with the Guru. The antidote to that is to go back and do those things that the Guru, the very, very simple things that the Guru has suggested that we do, do them and you'll get back in tune. So then I skipped over the material desire, Duryodhana, associating with material desire. For a lot of people, this would be the top of the list. But for devotees, by and large, we aren't as pulled into material desire. Still, there's some of that lingering pull toward the unnecessary luxuries or the indulgences, as Devi was talking about. Materially, Swami has suggested one way to overcome those. When you have the desire to buy something or to get something, do a compromise. Say, okay, I will buy that. I will get that. And then give it away. So when material desire is pulling on you, to give away counteracts that. That's why the practice of tithing is so important spiritually, to take that which you have received and give the first gift of that back to God. I would like to suggest if anyone in this room is not tithing, start that practice. It is a very, very powerful spiritual practice, because the hardness of the heart, the fear and the contractiveness says, I don't have enough, I can't share, I can't give back, I have to clutch it all to myself. And that clutching to yourself shuts off that upward flowing stream. So if you have a material desire, go ahead and get it and then give it away or give to other people. But in these ways, we can, yes, there are these elements that pull us away from God, but we don't have to give in to them. We don't have to become enslaved by them. We can do those spiritual, psychological, emotional practices that work to get us out. The simple formula is this. Anytime you feel yourself pulled in a negative direction, think, what is the opposite of this negative direction? And then put your energy into that opposite. Fighting negativity with negativity does not work. As Swami puts it in his song, you can't beat out darkness with a stick. You have to turn on the light. And as Master put it, for all of us, the great hope is, even though a place has been dark for a million years, as soon as you flip the light switch, it becomes light. You don't have to wait another million years to balance out the light. Spring in the light and that darkness disappears. So the most important, Devi touched on, but I'll just re-emphasize it. Attunement with the Guru is not just a good practice. It is everything, because The Guru is that aspect of God that has come to lead us individually out of the darkness into the light. Attunement with the Guru, do everything possible to increase your attunement with the Guru. I'll end just with this very sweet little, not even a story, just something that happened last summer. We were walking with Swami and in the garden, and as we were headed back to the house, he just stopped. And you could see that he was recollecting something. He said, oh, that's what it was. He was remembering an incident from 50, well, Master passed away in 1952, so that's 58 years ago. So Swami was remembering an incident 60 years ago. He said, ah, oh, I remember how Master raised his eyebrow when he said that. The raise of the eyebrow meant that he wasn't talking to that person. He was talking to me. Isn't that something? Now that's how we become attuned with the Guru, is you keep dwelling. What did he, obviously we don't have the individual connection with Master to remember that, but we have thousands of things that we've read or things that we've heard. What did Master mean by that? What was the innermost meaning of that? So keep the mind going in that way. And when we do that, we will get really to the point where, as Swamiji has said, I can't really tell any longer where Kriyananda stops and Yogananda starts. Said it's all kind of merged together. Said Kriyananda now is just an event I feel responsible for. That's where we're headed. God bless you.